Chapter 5. Cindy Edwards had been nothing but cordial toward him, responding promptly to his greeting every time he held the car door open for her, asking, albeit disinterestedly, how his day was going, saying please and thank you as often as she needed to. And yet, whenever she was in the car, he stiffened up. Was he breathing too loudly? Driving 5 miles per hour too fast or too slow? Had he cleaned the back seat well enough so a lingering speck of dust wouldn't dirty her pantsuit? He knew she'd have to be a precision-obsessed woman with the sensitivity of a champion watchdog to notice such minor transgressions. But that wasn't enough to allow him to sit at ease. He was still new at the job, and thus had to be perfect. Thankfully, she was on her cell phone most days. Like the Tuesday 2 weeks after he began driving her and her family. That afternoon, upon re-entering the car in front of a restaurant near Union Square, she had immediately gotten on her phone. "Vince won't be coming to Aspen," she'd said slowly and sadly, almost in shock, as if reading aloud the headline of a bizarrely tragic news story from the paper. 2 hours earlier, a much happier Cindy had exited the car, and it had been clear to Jende that the young man she was meeting in front of the restaurant was her son Vince. He was a replica of his father, bearing the same 6-foot frame, slender build, and wavy hair. Cindy had all but sprinted out of the car to get to him, to hug him and stroke his cheeks and give him 3 kisses. It seemed she hadn't seen him in months, which, based on what Mighty had said, was entirely likely. For minutes, they had stood on the sidewalk chatting, Vince rubbing his hands and moving them in and out of his blue Columbia hoodie, Cindy motioning toward Union Square Park and smiling broadly, as if reminding Vince of a special moment they'd once shared there. "I just had lunch with him," she went on. "He didn't say why. No, he says he's definitely not coming. I said he said he's not coming. He's going to some silent retreat in Costa Rica, something about his spirit badly needing to get away from the noise. What do you mean it's okay? Don't tell me it's okay, Clark. Your son's deciding to not spend the holidays with his family, and you're telling me it's fine? No, I don't expect you to do anything. I know there's nothing you can do. I know there's nothing I can do. But doesn't it bother you? I mean, do you not care how he has no sense of family? He doesn't come for Mighty's birthday, doesn't even care to ask me before deciding to go away for Christmas. I'm not rescheduling it. Sure, it might all be for the best. You're now free to work on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, and why don't you just work nonstop till next year? Don't tell me I'm being ridiculous. If you cared more, Clark, just a little bit more, about how the boys are doing, if they're happy. I don't want you to do anything else because you're incapable of looking past yourself and putting the needs of others above yours. Yeah, of course. But someday you're going to have to realize that you can't keep on doing what you're doing and hope that somehow, by chance, the kids are going to be all right. It doesn't work like that. It'll never work like that.
Jende heard her toss her phone onto the seat. For a minute the car was silent, except for the sound of her heavy breathing.
"Are you coming to Mighty's recital?"
she said, after picking up the phone and apparently calling her husband again.
"Yes, call me right back, please. I need to know ASAP.
His hands firmly at the 9 and 3 o'clock positions, as he'd been taught to drive in Cameroon, Jende made a turn onto Madison Avenue. The sun had already left the city on the frigid, late afternoon, but Manhattan shone brightly, as always, and beneath its street lamps and in the white lights spilling from glowing stores, he saw faces of many colors going north and south at varied speeds. Some along the crowded avenue looked happy, some looked sad, but none seemed to be as sad as Cindy Edwards at that moment. Her voice was so drenched in agony, Jende wished someone would call her with good news, funny news, any kind of news to make her smile. Her phone rang, and she promptly picked it up.
"What do you you mean you'll make it up to him? She shouted. You promised him you'd be at the recital. You can't keep telling a child. I don't care what's going on at Lehman. I don't care how awful things might get if Lehman doesn't. And what about the accordion gala? I need to RSVP by the end of the week. Oh, no, please go on the trip. Clark, just...
She tossed the phone aside again and sat with her left elbow against the car door, resting her head in her hand. She sat like that for minutes, and Jende thought he heard the sniff of a downcast woman fighting back tears. Somewhere in the East 40s, she picked up the phone again.
Hey, Cherie, it's me,
she said after the voicemail prompt, her voice placid, but the anguish therein still evident.
Just calling, nothing much. I finally got the tickets, so we're good. Call me back if you're free. I should be home in about... Never mind. You don't need to call me back. I'm good just having a real crappy day. You're probably still out with your clients. Oh, well. By the way, let me know if you'd like some company when you go visit your mom next week, okay? I'll be glad to come with you.
She dialed another number, and this time the person appeared to pick up.
Are you home?
She asked.
Oh, right. I forgot. Yeah, we can talk later. Tell Mike I say hello. Nothing. I mean, nothing new. Just the same old things. I'm just so upset and on top of everything else that's going on. No, I'm sorry. Please go. No, you don't have to call me back tonight. Yes, really. I'm fine. I'll be fine, June. Promise. Go. Have fun.
For the remaining 10 minutes of the ride, she made no phone calls. She sat quietly, looking out the window, watching happy people marching up and down Madison. Chapter 6. They had crossed the Delaware Memorial Bridge and were more than halfway back from Washington, D.C., cruising through New Jersey with turnpike signs appearing every few miles.
Tell me about Limbe, Clark said. I want to hear about this place where you grew up.
Jende smiled.
Oh, sir,
he said, his voice rising with nostalgia.
Limbe is such a nice town. You have to go there one day, sir.
In fact, sir, you really must go. When you go, you will see a sign welcoming you as you enter. The sign is special, sir. I have never seen a sign like that welcome anybody to any place before. You see it just as you are coming down the road on the way from Douala, after you pass mile 4. Nobody can miss it above their heads. It is there in big letters, supported by 2 iron red pillars, going from one side of the road to the other side. It says, Welcome to Limbe, the town of friendship. When you see that sign, sir, no matter who you are, whether you are coming to Limbe just for one day or to stay for 10 years, whether you are big or small, you feel happy that you have made it to Limbe. You will smell the ocean breeze coming from plenty of miles away to salute you.
That sweet breeze,
it will make you feel like truly there is no place in the world like this town by the ocean called Limbe.
Interesting, Clark said, closing his laptop.
It is, sir,
Jende replied, eager to tell more.
He knew Mr. Edwards was open to hearing more. After 3 months of driving around together, he'd come to realize that whenever the boss needed a short break from his computer or his phone or the papers scattered on the back seat, he asked him questions about his childhood, his life in Harlem, his weekend plans with his wife. And then, after the welcome sign, sir, he continued, as you pass through mile 2, you will see the lights of the town at night as they are shining all around you. The lights are not too bright or too many. They are just enough to say that this is a town made of magic. An OPEC city. National refinery on one side of the shore. Fishermen with their nets on the other side. Then, when you enter mile 1, sir, you begin to really feel Limbe proper. It's something else, sir.
Sounds like it.
Ah, yes, sir.
Limbe is very special, Mr. Edwards. In Limbe, we live simple lives, but we enjoy our lives well. You'll see it when you visit, sir. As you keep on driving through Mile One, you will see young men buying grilled corn on street corners and old men playing draughts. The young women have all kinds of fake hair weaved into their hair. Some of them look like Mamiwata, those mermaids in the ocean. The older women tie two wrappers, one on top of the other. That is how mature women like to dress. Soon after, you will be at Half Mile Junction. There, you will have to decide whether to turn right toward Bota and the plantations, left toward Newtown, where I am from, or continue straight toward Down Beach, where you will see the Atlantic Ocean. Fascinating, Clark said, reopening his laptop. I swear to you, sir, it is the best town in Africa. Even Vince says it's the type of town he wants to live in.
Of course he did, Clark said. He looked up at Jende in the rearview mirror. When did he say this?
2 nights ago, sir, when I was driving him back uptown after dinner.
What dinner?
He was home to have dinner with Mighty and Mrs. Edwards, sir.
Right, Clark said. He moved his laptop to his left and picked up a folder of documents held together by jumbo paperclips.
He's a very funny guy, Vince, Jende said, smiling. He thinks Obama is not going to do anything about...
So why are you here?
I'm sorry, sir?
Why did you come to America if your town is so beautiful?
Jende laughed, a brief, uneasy laugh.
But, sir, he said, America is America.
I don't know what that's supposed to mean.
Everyone wants to come to America, sir. Everyone to be in this country, sir, to live in this country. Ah! It is the greatest thing in the world, Mr. Edwards.
That still doesn't tell me why you're here.
Jende thought for a second. He thought about what to say without saying too much.
Because my country is no good, sir. He said. It is nothing like America. I stay in my country, I would have become nothing. I would have remained nothing. My son will grow up and be poor like me.
Just like I was poor, like my father.
But in America, sir, I can become something.
I can even become a respectable man. My son can become a respectable man.
And that could never happen in your country?
Never, Mr. Edwards.
Why? Clark asked, picking up his buzzing phone.
Jende waited for him to finish his conversation, a 10-second discussion during which he only said,
Yes. No. No, I don't think he should be fired for that.
The phone buzzed again, and he told whoever was on the line to call HR and tell them he was going to take care of it. He hung up and asked Jende to continue.
Because in my country, sir,
Jende said, his voice 10 decibels lower, far less unbound and animated than it had been before he heard that someone was in danger of being fired.
For you to become somebody, you have to be born somebody first. You do not come from a family with money, forget it. You do not come from a family with a name, forget it. That is just how it is, sir. Someone like me, what can I ever become in a country like Cameroon? I came from nothing. No name, no money. My father is a poor man. Cameroon has nothing.
And you think America has something for you?
Yes, sir, very much, sir, he said, his voice escalating once more. America has something for everyone, sir. Look at Obama, sir. Who is his mother? Who is his father? They are not big people in the government. They are not governors or senators. In fact, sir, I hear they are dead. And look at Obama today. The man is a black man with no father or mother trying to be president over a country.
Clark did not respond, picking up his buzzing phone instead.
Yeah, I saw his email.
he said to the person on the line. Why?
I don't know what to say. I'm not sure what Tom's thinking.
No, Phil, no. I completely disagree.
We can't keep on doing the same things and expect that the results will be different.
Right. Let's stick with the strategy even though for 3 years we've been making one poor choice after another. I mean, the level of short-sightedness here.
He scoffed and shook his head.
I've spoken up as much as I can.
No, I won't.
What baffles me is how no one else, I mean, no one except for maybe Andy, sees how ridiculous it is that we've been doing the same things over and over and expecting that somehow we'll survive. We've got to change course now. Completely rethink our strategy. Repo 105 isn't going to keep us sailing forever.
I don't believe that will either, and I've told Tom that.
Everyone's in denial. I don't get how no one's thinking about the fact that superficial short-term fixes are only going to come back to haunt us.
Of course they will.
How? Are you really asking me that? Have you thought for a second about the fact that everything's on the line if this shit blows up? Our lives, our careers, our families, reputations.
Trust me, it will.
And I can guarantee you that the feds will be ready to hang Tom the way they hung Skilling. And the rest of us...
For a few seconds he said nothing, listening to his colleague.
You think it's going to be that nice and clean, huh?
He said.
Somehow everyone's just going to walk away nice and clean from the burning building.
No.
How long we've been at it isn't going to mean anything pretty soon. Hell, it doesn't mean anything right now, Phil. We're drowning.
He took a deep breath as he listened again, then laughed.
Fine,
he said. I could use that. Maybe one round. Haven't been on a course in a while. No, save that for yourself. One round of golf sometime soon will be enough. No. Thank you very much, Phil. Not my cup of tea.
Yes, I promise. I'm going to desperately beg you for her number as soon as I find myself on the verge of an explosion.
He hung up, reopened his laptop, smiling and shaking his head, and began typing. After 30 minutes of silence, he put his laptop aside and made 3 phone calls, to his secretary, to a person named Roger about the report he hadn't yet received, to someone else to whom he spoke in mediocre French.
Always fun getting a chance to practice my French with the team in Paris, he said after he'd hung up.
It is very good French, Mr. Edwards,
Gende said.
You lived in Paris?
Yeah, for 1 year, while I was studying at Stanford.
Gende nodded, but did not reply.
It's a college,
Clark said,
in California.
Ah, Stanford. I remember them now, sir. They play good football, but I have never been to California. Is that where you are from, sir?
No. My parents retired there. I grew up in Illinois, Evanston. My dad was a professor at Northwestern, another college.
My cousin Winston, sir. When he first came to America, he lived in Illinois for a few months. But he called us all the time, saying he was ready to leave because of the cold. I think that is why he joined the army, so that he could move to a warm place.
I don't see the logic there, Clark said, chuckling. But yes, it's very cold. I can't tell you Evanston's anything as wonderful as your Limbe. But we had a great childhood there, my sister, Cece, and I. Riding our bikes around the block with the other neighborhood kids, going with Dad downtown to Chicago to museums and concerts, picnicking by the lake. It was a really wonderful place to be a kid. Cece's thinking she might move back there one day.
Oh, yes, your sister, sir. I did not know you are a twin. It was only a few days ago that Mighty told me your sister is your twin sister. I really like twins, sir. In fact, if God gives me one...
Speaking of which, I need to check up on her,
Clark said as he pressed a few keys on his phone.
Hey, it's me,
he said after the voicemail greeting.
Sorry I didn't call back last week. Ridiculously busy at work, so much going on. Anyway, I spoke to Mom last night, and she told me you and the girls aren't coming to Mexico.
Cease. Listen.
Put everything on my credit card, okay? I'm sorry if I haven't made it clear enough, but I want you to put everything you can't afford on that credit card. Everything. The flight, the hotel, the rental car, Kayla's braces, whatever you need. Just put it on the card. You know how much all of us being there means to them. It's Dad's 80th, Cease. And I want to see the girls. It's been so crazy at work. I'm barely breathing, but I'll try to pick up the next time you call. Or email. You know email or text is always better for me. He threw his head back after hanging up. His eyes closed. So you didn't have a job back home? He asked Jende, opening his eyes and picking up his laptop.
Oh, no, sir. I had a job, Jende replied. I worked for the Limbe Urban Council.
And it wasn't a good job? Jende laughed, taken aback by Clark's question, which he found naive.
Sir, he said, there is no good or bad job in my country.
Because?
Because any job is a good job in Cameroon, Mr. Edwards. Just to have somewhere that you can wake up in the morning and go to is a good thing. But what about the future? That is the problem, sir. I could not even marry my wife. I did...
What do you mean you couldn't marry? Poor people get married every day.
Yes, they can, sir. Everyone can marry, sir, but not everyone can marry the person that they want.
My wife's father, Mr. Edwards, he's a greedy man. He refused for me to marry his daughter because he wanted my wife to marry someone with more money. Someone who can give him money whenever he asks for it. But I didn't have. What was I supposed to do?
Clark snickered. I guess people don't elope in Cameroon, huh?
Arope, sir.
No, elope. You know, when you run away and get married without involving your crazy family.
Oh, no, 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 sir. We do it. People do it. We also do come we stay, which means a man says to a woman, come, let us live together. But he does not marry her first.
But I could never do that, sir.
Never.
Why?
It does not show respect for a woman, sir. A man has to go to a woman's family and pay bride price for her head, sir, and then take her out through the front door. I had to show I am a real man, sir. Not take her for free, as if she is something I picked on the streets.
Right, Clark said, snickering again. So, you've paid for your wife?
Oh, yes, sir,
Jende said, beaming with pride.
Once I come to America, and send my father-in-law a nice transfer through Western Union. He sees that maybe I am going to be a rich man one day. He changed his mind.
Clark laughed.
I know it is funny, sir, but I had to get my wife. By 2 years after I came to New York, I had saved good money to pay the bride price and bring her and my son over here. I sent money to my mother and father, and they bought everything my father-in-law wanted as the bride price. The goats, the pigs, the chickens, the palm oil, bags of rice, the salt, the cloth, bottles of wine. They bought it all. I even gave an envelope of cash, double what he asked for, sir.
No kidding.
No, sir. Before my wife comes to America, my family goes to her family, and they hand the bride price and sing and dance together. And then we were married.
Clark's phone buzzed.
Fascinating story, he said, picking it up and putting it back down.
And the truth, sir,
Jende went on, unable to stop himself,
is that the paper I signed as marriage certificate at City Hall is not what makes me feel like I marry my wife. That does not mean too much. It is the bride price I paid. I give her family honor.
Well, Clark said, clicking on his laptop, I hope she's been worth it.
Oh, yes, sir. She is. I have the best wife in the whole world, sir.
They drove in silence for the next 45 minutes. Traffic was sparse in the lower part of New Jersey except for tractor trailers, which seemed to appear out of nowhere. "So, you think America is better than Cameroon?" Clark asked, still looking at his laptop.
1 million times, sir, Jende said. 1 million times. Look at me today, Mr. Edwards, driving you in this nice car. You are talking to me as if I am somebody, and I am sitting in this seat, feeling as if I am somebody.
Clark put aside the laptop and picked up another folder, one with loose sheets. He flipped through the sheets, scribbling on a writing pad.
What I'm curious about still, he said, without pausing to look up at Jende, is how you could buy a ticket to come to America if you said you were that poor.
Once more, Jende thought of the best answer. There was no shame in telling the truth, so he told it.
My cousin, sir, he said. Winston. The associate at Dustin Connors and Salmon.
Yes, sir. He is the one who bought me a ticket. He felt sorry for me. My cousin, he's a better brother to me than some of my brothers from the same mother, same father.
And how did he get here?
He won the green card lottery, sir. Then he joined the army. He used the money.
I know, Clark said. Frank told me.
His phone buzzed. He looked down at it and turned his face toward the window. The phone buzzed several more times before he picked it up.
No, I haven't, he said to the caller. Why?
The car in the left lane honked and cut in front of them.
Arizona, he said. When did he tell you this?
Never mind. I'll call him right now.
No, I'm not mad. He's got to have a pretty good reason, which I'd like to hear. Of course, I don't think it's a good idea. Yes, yes, I'll talk to him.
He quickly dialed a number.
Hi, it's Dad, he said. Give me a call when you can, will you? Mom just told me you turned down the Skadden internship offer, and she's very upset. Why are you doing this? She says you want to spend a month at a reservation in Arizona. I'm not sure what your thinking is. Skadden's a great opportunity for you, Vince. You can't just throw it away because you'd rather go sit around in Arizona. Can't you go there before or after the internship? Please, call me back as soon as you get this. Or come to my office tomorrow. Call Leah and check my calendar. Just wish you'd talk to me before making a decision like this. I wish you didn't go about making major decisions without talking to Mom and me. It's the very least you can do.
He hung up and sighed. A sigh as deep and audible as it was hopeless and defeated.
Unbelievable, he muttered to himself. Unbelievable.
In the front seat, Jende drove in silence, though he yearned to tell Mr. Edwards he was sorry Vince had upset him, that nothing could be harder than a disobedient son. For 20 minutes they rode up the turnpike in silence, from exit 9 toward Rutgers University to exit 10 for Perth Amboy, behind tractor trailers and beside sedans with napping babies and dogs sticking out their heads for air. Above a sky that bore the same cumulus clouds that had been following them like spies for 3 hours. Clark made a call to Frank, asked if he could arrange an internship for Vince at Dustin in case Skadden's was no longer available, in case Vince realized that he had to start acting like a grown man.
I'm glad you understand what an opportunity you've been given, Clark said to Jende after getting off the phone with Frank.
The tallest skyscrapers of Manhattan had just begun appearing as they entered northern New Jersey.
I'm glad someone understands when they've been given a great opportunity.
Jende nodded with every word. He thought about the best thing to say to make Clark feel better, the right thing to say to his boss at a time like this. He decided to say what he believed.
I thank God every day for this opportunity, sir, he said,
as he switched from the center to the left lane.
I thank God, and I believe I work hard, and one day I will have a good life here. My parents, they too will have a good life in Cameroon, and my son will grow up to be somebody, whatever he wants to be. I believe that anything is possible for anyone who is American. Truly do, sir. And in fact, sir, I hope that one day my son will grow up to be a great man like you.
Chapter 7. On a sunny day, it was hard to see how far the Lehman Brothers' office tower extended into the sky. Its walls seemed to soar on forever, like an infinite spear, and though Jende sometimes pushed his head far back and squinted, he couldn't see beyond the sunlight banging against the polished glass. But on a cloudy day, like the day he finally met Clark's secretary, Leah, in person, he could see all the way to the top. Even without the sun's rays falling on it, the building glimmered and Lehman Brothers stood regal and proud, like a prince of the street. Leah had called him around noon, saying he needed to drive back to Lehman from wherever he was. Clark had forgotten an important folder in the car and needed it for a 3 o'clock meeting.
"No, I'll meet you downstairs,"
she said after Jende offered to bring it upstairs.
"Clark's going crazy today and I could use some air," she whispered.
She arrived downstairs while he was leaning against the car with the folder in his hands. He had expected her to be small, tiny even, based on her high-pitched, honeyed voice and the girly manner in which she sometimes giggled at banal things he said. But she was wide and round, like some of the people he'd seen when he landed at Newark. Thick and fleshy humans, who had made him wonder if America was a country of large people. In Limbe, there were perhaps two people of that size in a neighborhood of hundreds, but at the airport, walking from the plane through immigration and customs to baggage claim, he had counted at least 20. Leah wasn't as plump as the largest of the women he'd seen that day, but she was tall, a head above most of the women standing in front of the building. She walked toward him, waving and smiling, dressed in a lime green sweater and red pants, sporting a curly bob that reminded him of the crazy wig Nani wore whenever Fatou didn't have time to braid her hair.
"So good to finally meet you," Leah chanted,
her voice even more sugary than on the phone. Her lipstick matched her pants, and her round face had at least a half dozen layers of makeup, which were woefully failing in concealing the deep lines circling her mouth.
"Me too, Leah," Jende said, smiling back and handing her the folder. "I was wondering if you are going to know it was me."
"Of course I was going to know it was you," Leah said. "You look very African, and I mean that in the nicest way, honey. Most Americans can't tell Africans from islanders, but I can pick out an African from a Jamaican any day. I just know these things."
Jende chuckled nervously and said nothing, waiting for Leah to say goodbye and leave, which she didn't. What was she going to say next, he thought. She seemed nice, but she was most likely one of those American women whose knowledge of Africa was based largely on movies and National Geographic and third-hand information from someone who knew someone who had been to somewhere on the continent, usually Kenya or South Africa. Whenever Jende met such women, at Leomi's school, at Marcus Garvey Park, in the livery cab he used to drive, they often said something like, "Oh my God, I saw this really crazy show about such and such in Africa." Or, "My cousin, friend, neighbor used to date an African man, and he was a really nice guy." Or, even worse, if they asked him where in Africa he was from, and he said Cameroon, they proceeded to tell him that a friend's daughter once went to Tanzania or Uganda. This comment used to irk him until Winston gave him the perfect response. "Tell them your friend's uncle lives in Toronto," which was what he now did every time someone mentioned some other African country in response to him saying he was from Cameroon. "Oh yeah," he would say in response to something said about Senegal. "I watched a show the other day about San Antonio." Or, "One day I hope to visit Montreal." Or, "I hear Miami is a nice city." And every time he did this, he cracked up inside as the Americans' faces scrunched up in confusion because they couldn't understand what Toronto, San Antonio, Montreal, Miami had to do with New York.
"So, how do you like working for Clark?" Leah asked,
wisely skipping all the questions about Africa.
I like it very much, Jende replied. He is a good man.
Leah nodded, pulling out a pack of cigarettes from her purse and moving to lean against the car next to Jende.
Mind if I smoke?
Jende shook his head.
He's a good man to work for, Leah said, puffing out a straight line of smoke. He's got his bad days, when he gets on my nerves, and I just want to throw him out the window. Otherwise, I've got no complaints. He's treated me very well. Never thought about leaving him.
You have been his secretary for a long time?
15 years, honey, Leah said. Though I can't say I've got too many left. With the way this company is going, the whole place is a big stinky mess.
Jende nodded and looked toward the building's entrance at the 20-something-year-old young man in a black suit who was pacing to the right of the doors, his anxiety apparent in the way he paused every few steps to stare at the ground. Jende imagined he was on his way to a job interview, or spending his first day at the company, or his last.
Ever since the subprime unit fell apart, Leah went on, flicking the ashes off her cigarette, everyone's been nervous like crazy. And I hate being nervous. Life's much too short.
Jende thought about asking her what the subprime unit was and why it had fallen apart, but decided it was best not to ask about things he most certainly wouldn't understand, even if someone illustrated it to him with pictures.
I see how busy Mr. Edwards is, he said instead.
Oh, everyone's busy, Leah said. But Clark and his friends up there, they don't have any reason to be nervous. When it's time to lay off people, do you think they're the ones who'll be going? No, honey, it'll be us, the little people. That's why some people are already sending out resumes. I don't blame them. You can't ever trust these people.
I do not think Mr. Edwards will let you go anywhere, Leah. You are his right-hand woman.
Leah laughed.
You're sweet, she said,
smiling and revealing neatly arranged, smoke-stained teeth.
But no, I don't think it'll be his decision. And you know what? I don't give a damn. I can't lose sleep over this company. Everyone's gossiping, talking about stock prices going down, profits going down, all kinds of stinky things happening in the boardroom, but the top guys won't tell us squat. They're lying to us that everything's gonna be fine, but I see Clark's email sometimes, and well, pardon mon français, but there's a lot of dirty shit they're hiding.
I am sorry to hear, Leah.
Oh, I'm sorry too, honey, she said,
shrugging and pulling another cigarette from her purse.
And you know the worst part?
She went on, moving closer to Jende and lowering her voice.
One of the VPs I'm friendly with told me there's talk that there may be some Enron-type stuff going on, too.
Enron?
Jende asked, shifting his head to let Leah's smoke sail by.
Yeah, Enron.
Who was that, Leah?
Who?
This person, Enron. I don't know who he was.
Leah burst out laughing. She laughed so hard Jende feared she was going to choke on her smoke.
Oh, honey, she said, still laughing. You really just came to this country, huh?
Jende laughed back, embarrassed and amused all at once.
Maybe it's best you don't know what Enron was or what they did, Leah said.
But I would like to know, Jende said. I think I have heard the name somewhere, but I do not know what they did.
Leah pulled out her phone, looked at the time, and dropped the phone back in her purse.
They cooked books, honey,
she said to Jende.
They cooked books?
Yeah,
she said, her lips quivering in an attempt to suppress her laughter.
They cooked their books.
Jende nodded for a few seconds, opened his mouth to say something, shut it, opened it again, shut it again, and then shook his head.
I do not think I should ask any more questions, Leah,
he finally said, and they both burst out laughing in unison. Chapter 8 Midnight, and she still hadn't started. First it was Jende's work clothes she had to iron, then it was Leomi's homework she had to help with. After that, she had to cook dinner for the next day because between work and evening classes, there would be no time to cook and clean the kitchen. She had to do everything tonight. She had thought she'd be done with the chores by 10 o'clock, but when she looked at the living room clock, it was 11, and she hadn't washed her hair, which badly needed washing. By the time she came out of the shower, the only thing she could think about as she dressed in her sleeping kaba was her bed, but there would be no sleep for her just yet. She went into the kitchen and took the instant coffee out of the cabinet above the stove, turning her nose away as she opened the can to put 2 teaspoons of the ground beans in a mug. Nothing about coffee's forceful smell and dry, bitter taste pleased her, but she drank it because it worked. Always did. 1 cup, and she could stay up for 2 more hours. 2 cups, and she could be up till dawn, which wouldn't be such a bad idea tonight. She needed at least 3 hours of studying if she were to finish all her homework and start preparing for her upcoming precalculus test. Maybe she'd spend 2 hours on the homework and 1 hour on precalculus, or stay up 4 hours, do 2 hours on homework and 2 hours on precalculus. She needed an A on the precalculus test. An A-minus wouldn't be good enough. A B-plus definitely wouldn't do. Not if she hoped to finish the semester with at least a 3.5 GPA. She tiptoed into the bedroom and picked up her backpack, which was lying next to Leomi's cot. He was sleeping on his side, breathing silently, unlike his father, curled under a Batman comforter, his mouth open an inch, his right palm on his right cheek, as if he were pondering matters of great import in his dream. Quietly, she moved closer to him, pulled the comforter to his chest, smiled as she watched him sleep, before returning to the living room. For 3 hours she studied, first reading at the dinette in preparation for her next history class, afterward moving to the desktop by the window to finish the English composition essay she had started in the library, then returning to the dinette to study precalculus, referencing her class notes, her textbook, and practice problems and solutions she had printed from the internet. The silence in the apartment was like a celestial choir, the perfect background music to her study time. No one to disturb her, interrupt her, ask her to help do this or please come over right now. No sound but the faint noises of Harlem in the nighttime. Drinking a despicable beverage was a little price to pay for this joy of quiet. 2 students in her precalculus class had formed a study group and invited others to join, but she hadn't bothered replying to their emails. She couldn't give up this pleasure of being alone just to be able to study with others. It wasn't even as if there was much to gain from a study group. She had joined one earlier in the semester for her introduction to statistics class, and it had been nothing but an improper use of time. Barely 30 minutes into the group's first study session in the students' lounge, one of the members had suggested they order Chinese, as if their hunger couldn't be put on hold for 2 hours. Nanny had been sure the other members would say they weren't interested, but all of them, 2 young white women, an African-American youngish woman, a teenage-looking young man of indeterminable ethnicity, were in agreement that it was a great idea. She'd had no choice but to order mushu pork and spend $10 she didn't want to spend, because she knew the sight of the others eating would make her hungry and ultimately chew into her concentration for the duration of the session. The group had stopped studying to order, stopped studying again to eat. While they ate, they chatted about American Idol. Who was better than whom? Who was most likely going to win? Who was definitely not going to win? The conversation didn't return to the upcoming test for a whole hour. Perhaps losing an hour of study time was nothing to them. It was something to her. Around 3:30, she went to the kitchen for another cup of coffee. Opening the can of instant coffee the second time was better, but the ground beans were still a foul-smelling thing, and no one could convince her otherwise. She returned to the dinette, took a sip of the coffee. She rested her head in her right hand, closed her eyes, and exhaled. For a minute she kept her eyes closed, staring at the billions of tiny bright spots floating in the blackness. How good would it be to stay in this stillness for much longer, she thought, with nothing to do, nowhere to go. Her mind was always active, it seemed. What needed to be done, by when, how long it would take to get done. Even when she sang during her chores, she was mindful of the next chore, and the one after that. Life in America had made her into someone who was always thinking and planning the next step. She opened her eyes. She'd had enough studying for now, she decided. The pre-calculus test wasn't for another 2 weeks. She was in a good place with her preparation. She'd do a round of practice problems on Sunday, another round the night before the test, and come test day, she'd be ready. Chapter 9. He knew bad news could come even on the happiest of days. He knew it could arrive even when sadness was as far from the heart as Ras Ben Saka is from Cape Agulhas. He knew any given day could be like the day his brother sent a text message asking him to call back as soon as possible. That had been a good day, a warm, sunny Saturday. He was at the Red Lobster in Times Square with Neni and Leomi, eating with his favorite people at his favorite restaurant. He had immediately called his brother back and listened to him say in a panicked voice that their father had come down with an ugly case of malaria and could barely talk. Pajonga's eyes had rolled to the back of his head, Chende learned, and he was now in a conversation with his long-dead father. He needed to be rushed to a private hospital in Douala. Money for the hospital could be borrowed from a businessman in Sokolo, if Chende could talk to the lender and promise to send the funds for repayment as soon as possible. I beg you, Chende, his brother had said. You get for promise for send the money now, so Papa go die by daybreak. Chende had not been able to finish his food after that call. Neni had asked the waiter to wrap up the sautéed shrimp while Chende ran, first to an ATM to withdraw money from their savings account, and then to a bodega bearing a Western Union logo on its window, to transfer the funds to Cameroon. He ran along 8th Avenue like a deranged man, pushing aside tourists so he could send the money as soon as he could, even though the time would make no difference, since his brother would not be able to retrieve the money till Monday. His father had survived, and Chende had been reminded that indeed, bad news has a way of slithering into good days and making a mockery of complacent joys. But the day Boubacar called, that Tuesday in April 2008, was not a special day. Chende was at work, the weather was cold, the streets of Manhattan as brutal to drive on as any other day. He was parked on a street corner, reading Clark's discarded Wall Street Journal, when he saw Boubacar's name flashing on his phone. He picked up the phone warily, knowing it had to be big news, good or bad. Immigration lawyers, like doctors, did not call to say hello. Boubacar said hello, asked about his day. His voice was somber and serious, lacking the es and abis he often added at the end of sentences, and from that Chende could tell something was amiss. Even when Boubacar asked about Neni and Leomi and tried to make small talk about life as a chauffeur, Chende could tell the man was merely sterilizing a spot on his heart so he could inject painful words.
I finally received the letter, Boubacar said. What did they say?
The asylum application was not approved, the lawyer told him. The case was being referred to an immigration judge. Chende would need to appear in court because the government was going to begin removal proceedings against him.
I tried my very best, my brother, he said. I truly did. I'm sorry.
Chende said nothing. His heart was pounding too fast for his mouth to open.
I know it's not good news, my brother, but don't worry.
he went on.
We'll keep fighting. There is a lot we can do to keep you in the country.
Still, Jende could muster no words.
It's very hard, I knew. But we must try to be strong, okay?
The silence remained.
Stay strong, my brother. You've got to stay very strong. I know it's a mighty shock. Really, the decision is shocking me too very much right now. But what can we do? The only thing we can do right now is to keep fighting.
Finally, Jende muttered a barely audible something.
Huh? I say, this means I have to leave America? They say that, yes. They don't believe your story that you'll be killed by Nene's family if you go back to Cameroon. I thought you said it was a good story, Mr. Bubaka. In fact, you yourself told me that they would believe me. We left the interview happy. You told me I had answered the questions very well and that the immigration woman looked like she believed me. Yes, but like I told you the last time we spoke, I didn't think it was a good sign when she told us to go home and wait for the decision in the mail, instead of asking us to come back to the asylum office in a couple of weeks to pick it up. I didn't want to read too much into it. You told me not to worry too much about the fact that it was taking them too much time to mail us the decision, because immigration is very slow. That's what you said. They don't even have the decency to apologize and explain why it took them a whole eternity to make one decision. You didn't make it sound that bad, Mr. Bubaka. You told me that the woman was very satisfied with my answers. I thought so, my brother. I thought she was. But who knows how those bastards at immigration really think? We give them a story and hope they believe it. But some of them are wicked people. Very wicked. Some people in this country don't want people like me and you here. What is going to happen to me now? Are they going to arrest me and force me inside a plane? Will I get a chance to say goodbye? Oh, no, God forbid. Inshallah, it'll never get to that. No. For now, you are going to get a date when you have to stand in front of an immigration judge. ICE lawyer will be there, pushing for the judge to throw you out of the country. I will be there, standing next to you, pushing for you to remain. I'm going to do everything I can to convince the judge that the people at USCIS are wrong and that you belong in America. The judge will either side with ICE lawyer and deny your asylum application, or he'll side with us and approve the application so you can remain in the country and get a green card. Inshallah, the judge will side with us.
So, you are saying it's going to be you versus the lawyer from the government?
That's correct. Me versus their lawyer. Better man go in all. Oh, Papa God. I know, my brother. I know, believe me. But you have to put your faith in me. You must, okay? We are going to do this together. Have we not made it this far together?
Jende took in a deep breath. The car seat had turned into a bed of needles.
Did I not help you make it this far? Bubakar said. Did I not petition USCIS to give you a work permit when they were taking too long to get your case? Eh? Is it not because of that work permit that you were able to get a driver's license and now you have a better job?
What am I going to do?
You've got to trust me. It's not that I don't trust. Did I not help you apply for a student visa for your wife to come here and go to school? I got your whole family together in New York, my brother. Got you this close. The least you can do is trust me that, inshallah, we will win this case, and you'll get a green card.
Jende's mouth dried up. Bubakar asked if he had any other question. When do I have to be in court? He asked softly, dreading the response. Bubakar said he didn't know. He'd received only a letter of explanation today, but Jende should be getting the notice to appear with a court date soon enough.
Have any more questions, my brother?
Chende said no. He could think of nothing more to say or ask.
Call me any time with any questions, okay? Even if you just want to talk.
Chende hung up. He dropped his phone on his lap. He did not move. He could not move. Not even his mind could move. The ability to create thoughts deserted him. What he'd lived in fear of the past 3 years had happened, and the powerlessness was worse than he imagined. If not for his pride, he would have cried. But tears, of course, would have been useless. His days in America were numbered, and there was nothing salty water running out of his eyes could do. Upper West Siders strolled by. MTA buses stopped by. A chaos of kids on scooters rushed by, followed by three women, their mommies or grandmas or aunties or nannies, cautioning them to slow down. Please be careful. Mighty would soon be done with his piano lesson. Nanny would be calling in about 12 minutes to ask Chende to bring the car to the front of the teacher's building. What should he do in those 12 minutes? Call Nanny? No. She was probably on her way to pick Leomi up from his after-school program. Call Winston? No. He was working. It wouldn't be right to call him with bad news at work. Besides, there was nothing he could do. There was nothing anyone could do. No one could save him from American immigration. He would have to go back home. He would have to return to a country where visions of a better life were the birthright of a blessed few. To a town from which dreamers like him were fleeing daily. He and his family would have to return to Newtown empty-handed, with nothing but tales about what they'd seen and done in America. And when people asked why they'd returned and moved back into his parents' crumbling Karabot house, they would have to tell a lie, a very good lie, because that would be the only way to escape the shame and the indignity. The shame he could live with, but his failings as a husband and father. He looked out the window at the people walking on Amsterdam Avenue. None of them seemed concerned that the day might be one of his last in America. Some of them were laughing. That night, after he told Nanny, he watched her cry the first tears of sadness she'd ever cried in America.
What are we going to do? She asked him. What do we have to do?
I don't know, he replied. Please, dry your eyes, Nanny. Tears are not going to help us right now.
Oh, Papa God, what are we going to do now? She cried, ignoring his plea. How can we keep on fighting? How much more money do we need to spend now that it's going to be a court case?
I don't know, he said again. I'm going to call Boubacar soon to discuss more. The news hit me so bad. It was as if someone was pressing a pillow against my face.
They would have to use the money they had saved, they agreed. All of it. The couple $1,000s they had put away by sticking to a monthly budget in which they hoped to one day put toward a renovation of his parents' house, a down payment on a condo in Westchester County, and Leomi's college education. If they had to get rid of their cable and internet and take second jobs, they'd do that. If they had to go to bed hungry, they'd do that too. They would do everything they could to remain in America. To give Leomi a chance to grow up in America.
Should we tell Leomi now, so he can be prepared if we have to leave?
Nanny asked. Chende shook his head and said,
No, let him stay happy.
Chapter 10 She dragged herself through the city, from work to school to home, because she needed to carry on as if nothing had changed, as if their lives hadn't just been opened up to unravelment. She couldn't summon a smile, sing a song, or string together two thoughts without the word deportation finding its way in there. And yet she propelled herself forward the morning after the news, dressed in pink scrubs and white sneakers for a long day of work, an overloaded backpack strapped on her shoulders so she could study at work while the client slept. Fatigued, but unbowed,